Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pony Development Sync for Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. Is it 2020?
No.
Yes, it is. 2020. All right. Yeah, I'm good with the dates. I'm your host today, Sean Allen, because Andrew Turley is not around. And if everybody could go around and introduce themselves, please do that.
Hi, my name's Sylvan Klepsch, and I miss Andy.
Hi, my name's Theo Butler.
I'm Joe McAvoy.
I'm Gord Tischer.
And I'm Ryan Higginson.
Did we get everyone? Theo, did you introduce yourself?
I thought I did.
Okay, good. Well, I'm doing well, apparently. Okay. All right. So, well, we don't need Andy anyway because we don't need his script thing that I don't have on my computer because, oh my God, it would not work today. In case anybody missed it, last Tuesday sometime after the sync, I updated the labels on the PonyC repo, got rid of a bunch of labels and changed the labels over to the new ones that we had discussed, and in the process generated about something slightly less than 2,000 individual GitHub event changes. It basically every single issue changed. So Andy's thing that would find changes to any issues would find every single one as of last week. So that would be fun. Before we get into stuff, there was something that we had started as a discussion in the sync channel of the Zulip that I wanted to go over folks here. Joe was part of that conversation. So I'm working on automating the creation of our release notes. For folks who are not aware, currently the release notes for PonyC are done by hand. A person asks the people when they're doing PRs or whatever to create release notes. They get stuck onto a release issue where then when it comes time for the release, the human goes through whoever's doing the release, so basically me, and puts together release notes from that by hand. Because this is kind of a pain in the ass. When we do libraries and releases of things like Corral or PonyUp, we haven't been doing any release notes. It just it grabs the change log and that's it. But there's nothing, you know, in any way really, you know, no explanatory stuff about what's going on with that. So we're moving towards having it be where we can have release notes which are auto-generated. And part of that would be to make sure that there's a standard way to take in release notes with PRs from folks. Does everyone kind of understand like what the goal there is? Is there anything I should cover on the first part of that for folks before we continue forward?
Makes sense to me.
All right, I'm going to take silence to mean okay. So we had a conversation where we basically came down to two different options for how we could do this. I presented both the options, and in the conversation, we clarified them a little, but we basically had two different takes on what would be best to do. I'm going to call them the Joe side and the Eric side. Eric is not here. Joe is here, so his view might be a little more represented. So one possibility for doing this is that the release notes for a particular issue could be that top comment that somebody does, you know, when you open the PR and it takes the commit message and it sticks it in there. Is everybody familiar with what I'm talking about for that top comment on PRs that gets automatically populated on GitHub from the commit message? How about this? Is anybody not familiar with that? Okay, good. So one possibly be doing that. However, as Eric pointed out, this could be problematic in the sense that people put stuff like, hey, this issue closes, you know, this PR closes issue 24. There might be additional information in there, which is really relevant towards the PR, but is not relevant particularly towards what we'd want to have in release notes, which where it's really just public facing, as compared to that comment field is really for the way in general that we use it. It's really about, this is addressing people who are evaluating the PR, looking at the PR, not people who would then be consuming whatever the change is that might come from that PR. And that this could be problematic, and we'd probably have to ask people to go back and change that message at some point, which could result in some messiness there. Eric proposed that we have a known location where people, as part of their PR, check in a file which contains the release notes for their particular change, should they need the release notes. Similar to how with an RFC, there's a particular location where there's a file which is part of the PR, which contains all of the RFC comments. And then in the automated fashion for how I would do this, when a PR gets merged to master, what we'd look at is to see the commit when it goes to master. We look to see, did this come from a PR? If yes, okay, let's find any release notes that there might be for that based on the location where they were. We can grab those and use them to update the release notes from when the release comes out. Those are the two general approaches. That's where I lost my train of thought for a moment. Let me go look at the notes again here real quick for this.
Difference between the approaches?
Yes. So in general, let's see here. Hold on. I'm going to go back to the difference approaches. So, let's see, we kind of took care of that. So yeah, at this point, the original things where I proposed two things, there were some pros and cons to each, but at this point, between Eric, Joe, and I talking about it, there's not any particular back end pros or cons in terms of implementation for this, except that the probably the big difference would be is that really with the file, we would be asking people to add a additional file to their commit, but there would be a bot which will check for any time there's a change log label is added. So we would say, hey, please do blah, blah, blah to add, you know, the release notes to your thing. For where it comes from the comment, we would have the bot. It would be operating the same fashion, except it would ask people to update that top commit to be something which is purely release notes for another human being. And yeah, those are really the two approaches. Want to see if there's either of those that anybody on here particularly favors. Joe, I know you have a particular favorite, and you could talk towards that if you want. I have one which, after thinking about it for a while, I'm leaning towards, but let's hear from other folks.
I think when you said update the top commit, I think you meant top comment. Is that right?
Yes, the comment box. Yes, not asking them to update the commit. That comment box on the PR is initially filled out by whatever the commit message is. Yes, and then it becomes the top comment.
To my mind, again, this is gut reaction, so don't take me too seriously, but I kind of like the commit message one because I can fill in my commit message when I start my PR. It has the nature of the release notes, and then PR it. And if it turns out based on the comments that I need to do some changes, add some commits, I can just go back and edit that comment without editing the commit message and get the right thing.
It's pretty obvious to me. So with the other one, you wouldn't be editing the commit message. It's not the commit message you'd be coming from. You'd be checking in a file. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas this doesn't add something to my workflow. for my normal workflow where I'm not, the initial commit message that I put in is exactly what I want in release notes, and I don't change the release notes in the course of my PR, it means that my normal workflow remains exactly the same. Nothing happens.
Yeah, as long as your normal workflow is to write good commit messages, which it should be.
Fair enough.
Well, okay, that's not Sylvan's normal workflow then.
Super rough.
Anyway, that would be my preference too, right? I would kind of prefer that, but at the same time, I'm willing to go either way. I don't feel strongly about this issue, but that the idea of not taking extra files seems appealing to me. The most important thing that I said in the Zulip, I'll say again here, the most important thing to me is that we do not use a single file for all release notes, because then we get merge conflict.
Yes.
Just like we have when we ask people to upload a change log of mine.
Aren't we going to get into repo trimming issues where we have to trim those repos out?
We have to trim what out?
The release message files that get checked in.
Okay. So this is, let me explain the actual mechanical process a bit more to you, Sylvan. All right. Okay. If it's the file based one, then this is what would happen. All right. Is that the PR is going to be merged to master. There will be a GitHub action that checks for each commit that hits master, whether it was for a PR, okay? Yep. If it was for a PR and the PR had a changelog comment, right, which means that it should then, in theory, have a corresponding release notes, it would go and look at the files that were part of that commit and find the one for the release notes, which is going to be, it would be in like a standard release notes location. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. And it'll add it to the release notes, and it'll add it to
a release notes. It'll add it to nextrelease.md, which is the release notes for the next release. Okay. Yeah. And it will delete the file which was in the commit. Yeah. So at that point, and what we would end up with, and this would happen either way with the one where it comes from the top comment as well, is that when it comes time to do a release next. You know, nextrelease.md would become like 0.32.0.md, and we would have the release notes in the repo for each release going backwards in time, but only the release notes that get accumulated, not the individual files.
Right, which I love. That part is great. The per release release notes is super nice.
Yep.
Okay, so again, I'm like Joe. I'm okay with whatever people want to do on this. I do have a mild preference for the commit message / first comment box approach, but that's it.
So I have a mild preference for the file one, simply because I often convey information in the, I often, after I open a PR, I often add additional information to that one. Or, for example, where it might be that I'd have to remove stuff like, hey, this closes 22, 24, or whatever. I think it would be a little easier to explain to people what they need to put in the file. If it's like, hey, this file is just literally, you have this file, it's just for you, right? I think it'd be a little easier to explain it to folks, but I'm not super set either way.
Okay. Don't get me wrong. I think there's the equivalent. The workflow change for you would be, put that thing in the second comment box rather than in the commit message, or changing your comment box. The workflow change for me would be put that crap in a file instead of in my commit message.
So I think let me explain what would probably happen if you're somebody you've opened a PR and it gets a changelog tag added to it, right? The bot is going to come along, and if it's in the comment, what the bot will need to tell you is something like this. Hey, you know, it looks like we're going to need to generate release note information for your thing. Please make sure that the top comment box that you have is the content that you would want to have appear to end users in the release notes. It should have these general characteristics, blah, 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 blah. If there's any information that is currently in that box, which shouldn't be in the release notes, please copy it out and put it into a new comment on this PR. It would be something like that. Yep. For the file one, it would be like, hey, it looks like you're going to need to have release notes for this. It can look and see if there is a release notes file already, right? If there is, the bot wouldn't even say anything. Yeah. If there is not a release notes file, it would say, hey, looks like you're going to need release notes for this, right? Please add a file in this directory which contains XYZ information about your release and push it as an additional addition to this PR.
Yeah.
And that's why that second one I think is a little easier to explain to people than the first one.
Yeah, fair enough. But to my mind, but here's the deal. I'm totally happy to vote on this as long as you get 1,000 votes because you're the person who actually deals with this.
So I don't think from an implementation standpoint it's going to make one bit of difference to me.
Okay.
It should be getting that first.
I mean, you're also the person who deals with this sort of operationally, not just in terms of implementation. So if you feel that that's easier to explain, I just believe you. That's it.
Well, it might not. It's
okay, but there's Gordon. I'm not gonna have a better opinion on that than you are.
Gordon, Ryan, Theo, do you have any thoughts or opinions? I will say one thing quickly in response to yours, Sylvan. It's my assumption that implementing both of these will be equally easy. If one of them turns out to be considerably harder, then it's off the table. I'm going to make the decision at implementation time, but it looks to me like it should be pretty much equivalent.
Cool.
So, Gordon, Joe, Theo, any opinions?
My preference is the file-based approach. I think I agree with Sean that it just be easier to explain. And there's less likelihood to have some weird first comment end up in release notes because of some issue along the way. Whereas with the file-based approach, we could just easily use that.
Oh, I just thought of a pro to the file-based approach from that. Is that if we put the change and maybe this is a pro, maybe this isn't, but with the file based one, it's possible to merge a thing which has a change log entry which has no release notes, which could be a pro in the sense that if somebody could merge something like while the comment is still like not really ready, but then I guess you could just go back and change it. So, yeah, probably doesn't make a difference either way. Ryan likes the file-based approach because a little easier to explain. Theo, Gordon, opinions?
I have no strong opinion.
I have a very, very weak opinion tending towards the file-based approach.
Your reasoning being?
Largely... for the purposes of one, I think maybe implementation might be slightly easier, but of course I know nothing about GitHub Actions, so I shouldn't say that. And also for the reasons of explaining it to people, not having to worry about possibly including things like, you know, closes, number, or whatever.
Okay. I'm hearing a slight preference towards file just in terms of numbers. So I think I might give that one a try first. It is, I have a slight preference in that direction as well. It seems like there's three people with a slight direct preference in that, two in the other direction. So I will give that a look and see. And if it turns out to be particularly difficult, it might become the comment one instead.
I think Epic Eric was the other one in the Zulip who was involved in this as well, and he had a preference for the file too. Is that correct?
Yes, but it was with a change that he suggested that was a very important part of it in relation to your bringing up what my initial problem with the file one was, hey, this is going to have all these merge conflicts like the change log used to. And as Eric pointed out, we could do it the same way that the RFC bot is going to work with doing individually named files that come in as part of the thing, and then they can be renamed.
Sure.
They can be copied and renamed. So, yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to check and make sure that his opinion was represented in this sort of tallying as well. And it sounds like, yeah.
Well, that would put a little bit more towards the file one as well.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure I had the understanding correct. Yeah. Because I didn't want him to be excluded from the sort of tallying by
version. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely started on the comment side when that discussion with him started, but he presented a nice way to get around the merge conflict thing that we had with changelog, which was literally my biggest concern going into it. You know, I do not want to have the merge conflict issue that we used to have with the changelog. That was awful and horrible.
Yeah. Cool.
Alrighty. Okay. We are at my computer acting a little weird. We're at 24 past. Before we dive into any RFCs or issues or anything, is there anything that anybody's on the call would like to bring up to discuss before we move to the more mundane business of issues and PRs and whatnot? Sylvan, Joe, Gordon, Theo?
I'm all right.
All right. Let's see, because the thing is useless there. Let's check out. Do we have anything for, nothing on any of the RFCs at this point? We're still RFC number 161. Theo is still looking at getting some performance stuff for the difference between the iter tools approach and the maybe approach.
Yeah, so I've just posted a link in the PR to what I have found, mostly just in case anyone, you know, I know there are people on this call who are more familiar with reading LLVMIR than I am. Just take a quick look at this and see, because I'm a little bit tentative to say that this is the comparison I want to make.
Yeah, cool. I'm looking at it now.
Yeah. So the top one is using the maybe library as shown in the code snippet above.
Yeah.
So the top one's maybe, and the second one is iter. You can see the full implementation of the iter that I am using in main.pony. It's not the one in the Pony Center library, but it's pretty much the exact same thing, except it only has map and it has the maybe constructor.
Okay, cool.
I'm a bit surprised by what I'm seeing here, which is why I want someone to take another look at it.
So this is very exciting. We're getting 5 decent sized basic blocks versus 1.
Yeah, there's a lot of load instructions in that first one too.
Yeah, and something to take it in, that this is what I was checking, which is the reason why I just posted the link, is because my concern was that maybe something was going strange, since the apply method for benchmarking the iter implementation is actually propagating the partial call. I checked it with, you know, in the do not optimize parentheses, having it be try iter stuff L0, so making it effectively exactly like the maybe one, and same code, nothing changed.
Right.
But of course, the micro benchmark output, of course, you know, it's a micro benchmark first off.
Sure.
But yeah, it's the difference between them in this micro benchmark is negligible, I would say.
So there you go. I was expecting to see something.
Yeah. But I was expecting at least the IR to be more, certainly more similar to the maybe implementation. Considering the indirection of, you know, like having an iterator.
Check out some really interesting stuff. Lack of a store.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing allocated to store it into even, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if the do not optimize is really getting, I don't know, do you want to try running one that rather than running as a micro benchmark that just like prints the output and just to verify that,
that it's actually doing a thing, yeah.
Because don't get me wrong, I'm loving. Sometimes I'm just so happy with the Pony compiler, I don't know what to say, right? Like, that bench iter apply function is hilarious.
I'm still looking at it, and I don't believe that that's true.
I know, that's why
that's
I'm
my reaction to it right now. Is,
well, it's figured it out.
Really?
It knows exactly what it's doing. It's done the whole thing.
I know.
Like, the thing that has me slightly concerned is the ret at the end returning an at 110, but I was poking through the generated LLVM IR to try to figure out what the hell that is. I do not know.
Okay, another thing to try, Theo, to make sure that we're not getting like an unnatural optimization would be to take that X grant, like that X local as an argument to the function, so that we don't know statically when we're generating the function, we don't know statically whether it's a U64 or none. Because it seems like, right, in the second example, it definitely knows statically that it's U64, and it's taking advantage of that.
Oh, it sure does.
So, if it's abstracted behind a call, and that call is not inlined because of xfun, I don't know if that's cheating in the wrong direction or not, but...
Well, it's useful to check it out. So that's I'm trying to print stuff out first just to make sure
totally
it does the thing.
Also, I mean, this is hilarious, right? Like,
This other one, the one on top, is definitely it's checking the descriptor, so it does not know statically whether this is U64 or not.
Okay, I'm just going to keep looking at that going, I don't believe this. If people tell me it's true, I'll believe that. But my reaction to it is, what?
I mean, if nothing else, this is showing that there are cases in which the iter approach is allowing LLVM to do optimizations that the maybe approach does not. And this is like a legitimate thing, right?
Not have expected.
I was not expecting that either.
But I would be expecting, that we reach something more like parity if we can, like, kind of prevent that static knowledge of the U64-ness of that variable. By putting it behind a call or whatever it is we need to do to prevent the static knowledge. And then that would put them more on a level playing field, and you could see what it looks like when that optimization is not possible. And, you know, we might end up with some kind of answer that looks like, hey, the iter approach is actually better in certain circumstances where it can be known statically, and it's worse in circumstances when it's not. Or we could turn out that it's, like, better in circumstances where it can be known statically and equal in other circumstances. So that would be...
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, so I've done the printf thing. So like, even if it's of the iter stuff is, you know, going into a variable and then being sent to printf, it like it generates the same code and then just like plugs that into printf.
I just spent more
time. Now I'm gonna lift it out into another function.
I just spent more time looking at your two implementations, and I'm no longer quite so surprised, Theo.
Why is that?
Well,
what do you mean?
So the iter approach is basically, is this a maybe or not? Just straight off the bat without ever even doing the map. And
and
that could definitely allow it to do much better optimization.
Maybe it's wrapping it in an object every time.
LLVM would have initially generated a bunch of unoptimized IR that says, generate all this code. And then LLVM goes through and says, why are you checking that? I know that's a number. We're done here.
Like when I raised the concern about iter and versus maybe, I was just looking at the actual implementations inside for like map and everything. I didn't think about what it would look like this with you calling maybe first before the map. Right? Which kind of changes a lot of stuff. That's interesting.
So I'm almost done with the implementation where this is lifted into a function.
Yeah, and this the other thing that's great about the iter approach is that like either the U64 is there or it's not, rather than being there or none. Because when it's there or none, we have to wrap the U64 in an object descriptor then introduces indirection, whereas iter U64 either contains U64s or it doesn't, but it never contains none, so there's no need to wrap in an object descriptor, letting us know statically that it's always U64.
Yep.
So this may be a real improvement and not a false one. Like based on what Sean just said and also what I just said.
I'd be interested in seeing what happens with like the equivalent of like get or else type thing, which was part of the maybe one, right?
Because
this thing is a U64 or a none, and I want the U64, and if it's not there, give me this default value.
But check out the implementation that Theo has of maybe. It actually is storing an A or none, and it's absolutely doing consume value, and it's absolutely going to box that thing if it needs to store it in the long term. But yeah. We're constructing that whole thing on the stack, and so LLVM is just going, no, we're good, and gets rid of the whole
thing. I was expecting the heap to stack optimization to do a ton of work, which is why I told Sean initially, but I wasn't expecting it to be this good.
And the thing is, like one of the things that LLVM can't help us with is object descriptor and virtual calls and like type checking at runtime, right?
Yes.
And so maybe is doing this, you know, it's wrapping in an object descriptor and doing type checking at runtime, and LLVM can't see through that. That's opaque to LLVM.
Yeah. So fascinating that the iter approach might end up being just better across the board.
I love the micro benchmark results, though. They're hilarious.
It's like it's
2 million really iterations can't tell the difference.
That's going to need to be a really hot path.
That's going to be a hot path.
How hot is your path, Daddy? 2,000 iterations and rising. Sorry, 2 million? What was it? 2 million?
Yeah.
Yeah, I messed that one up. Oh, well.
Okay, so there is a big difference.
54 nanoseconds.
When you change it into a separate function.
Did you update the repo yet so I can refresh?
Not yet. 1 second.
That is literally the only thing we're doing is we're all sitting here looking at that repo.
All right. I'll copy and paste it into the README.
It's a thrilling discussion, though. Like you wouldn't think that looking at LLVM IR as a group would be thrilling, but it is.
Totally is. Why would you say something like that, Joe? Of course it's thrilling.
All right, so I'll get the IR of the function, and oh god, it's somewhere else.
That's the problem, is I've always been looking at LLVM IR alone, and so I've never experienced what it looks, what it feels like to look at it with a group, and the fun of reading the instructions.
And whenever, and normally whenever I'm looking at LLVM IR, it's like, IR, it's like, why you no worky?
Yeah, it's because something is horrible, and here we get to look at it because something is strangely awesome.
Oh god, now I'm getting really confused by the pony name mangling.
Okay,
okay, so I've just pulled it out into a function called f. Like, I just called it f, and there is a bench iter underscore ref underscore f underscore ow, and then there's also a bench iter underscore box f ow. It looks like they're the same, so I guess that's not a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, either one's going to be fine. It has to do with when you have a box method that's actually under the hood. It's a box method is actually a generic method that can accept ref, val, or box receivers, and that's so that you can do the right virtual dispatch.
Yeah, but I would expect only one of them to be used, so the other ones would be dead code.
Yeah, good point. I don't know.
Although xfun would keep it around, I think.
Ah.
Right. Okay.
Because xfun says, yeah, I may call one of these horribly mangled functions from C.
That makes sense. Gotcha. Okay. All right. So I guess I'll just put one of them in because they're exactly the same.
I sure hope they're exactly the same.
They are exactly the same. Don't you
sometimes
worry.
Sometimes they're not, because you get things like iterator stuff that does allocation, and it actually needs to allocate slightly different things. Like, for example, if the viewpoint adaptation changes the generic formal parameter to a type that's allocated in the function, you're going to actually get a different type descriptor.
So,
which is a little bit subtle for those who are following this at home.
Oh, what the? Oh my! Oh, what? It's getting inlined. It just got inlined, and then the function isn't being called.
Oh yeah, so yeah, xfun creates the function.
Yeah, it gets inlined anyway. Like, the function exists, but it's still getting inlined into the. Oh boy.
Actually, well, that's good to know. I didn't know if xfun would prevent inlining, but it sounds like it doesn't prevent inlining. It just,
I guess that's good,
generates
to know
the redundant function alongside the inlined one.
Yeah, so the code's exactly the same. Like, the generated code is.
Yeah, because it's going to do the same thing it did with the lambda. There's just no stopping that thing.
Doing hot path. All right.
That's amazing. Okay. What has my compiler done for me recently?
Ask not what your compiler has done for you.
This really brings me back to finding ways to implicitly specialize functions to get rid of, like, boxing and virtual calls.
Yep. Which we talked about.
Like, this is like a really hot button topic in my internal discourse about the future of the compiler.
Yeah. I think it's a really important one, especially when you see stuff like this where you go, oh my lord, that's a hell of a wasted optimization if you didn't get this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, because the fact that we're boxing that U64 or none is getting in LLVM's way quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think about that when I was like, oh, I think we probably want maybe because it'll be better, because I wasn't really... Yeah, I was only thinking about after that, not with that as well.
Yeah, I think the answer is maybe should be better, but right now it's not because we have this boxing that gets in the way.
Yeah. And of course iter should also be better, but that's more pending, like, you know, some improvements to the compiler in terms of like generic type inference and or just the default type parameter stuff as well.
Yeah.
Which would allow you to actually have more concrete types in the things that are returned without having massive overhead for the user.
Yeah, that's true.
I'd like to see like the results of something like a get or else, you know, for this, but assuming it's effectively the same, then I would say that we go with
the get or else approach. Like iter of maybe and then next, right? Or, oh, I see what you mean. Like,
no, you want to default if it's not there. If the thing you pass in is none, you want to use a default.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how, because that's the other bit of functionality, which is there in the maybe library, right? And to make sure that that doesn't like somehow blow up like the goodness that iter has here.
Yeah. Okay. I'll do that right now.
I would expect it to also be good. Because you can still, there'll still be no boxing, there'll still be no type of scripture checking or virtual calls or anything. So I'd expect it to also be good.
But yes, yeah, it's worth checking.
I expect it to be good as well, but on the other hand, I expected maybe to be better when I first went into it. So.
I expect it to be the same. We were both wrong.
When it comes to micro benchmarks, there's always going to be a lot of wrong to go around.
Yeah.
So much wrong to go around. Hey, Sylvan, while he's doing that, have you listened to the Boomtown Rats followed by the Jam today?
I was not able to do so due to too many people talking to me.
People, they're the worst. Man, just the worst. People wanting things, needing things.
Here's a pony question while Theo's doing that. Since we're talking about implicit specialization and that sort of stuff, Sylvan, do you have any like new or updated thoughts since the last time we talked about like heuristics of like what the compiler should look for when to specialize and when not to, or anything with like line caching or any of that like sort of very stuff that is well beyond my current understanding when it comes to me working on implicit specialization?
So interestingly, yes. So I think that implicit specialization is equivalent to the inlining and outlining problem.
Yeah.
So, when you go and you hand tool C and C++ code, very often the compiler doesn't give you the inlining behavior you want. And so you start using non-standard annotations like always inline and things like that. And people are usually pretty familiar with that. But it turns out that's really not nearly as much of a performance optimization as finding your slow path and removing it from your function and outlining it and making sure it goes into a never inline function where the slow path comes in at a later portion in the code so that the microcode decoder and the prefetcher can go through and actually fetch your code and do your L1I decode and never hit your slow path. And you have a function called dispatch the slow path that then you hit your code prefetcher and your microcode decoding and all this stuff, right? And there are basically no compiler level tools in any language to do outlining. And this doing specialization is, in my opinion, an equivalent problem because you're trying to decide is the final result going to be faster or slower? And it's the same sort of hot path, slow path. And am I going to be faster by removing this from this block of machine code that, you know, the code that will be jitted into actual machine code at runtime as microcode, right? When you go from the ISA to the microarchitecture, or by inlining it. And this is an unbelievably difficult heuristic. And I think there's some really interesting stuff about stochastic super optimization to look at this, but the most recent stochastic super optimization work that came out of Stanford, where stochastic super optimization is basically saying you add randomness to a sort of a brute force approach to taking much larger chunks of program and exploring optimization. It really just cannot, stochastic super optimization just can't cover the incredible quantity of code that you need to cover in order to do inlining and outlining decisions. So I've been thinking about it a ton. Unfortunately, my answer is, oh God. That's it. That's what I got.
Well, that's helpful. So So real quick, understanding, like, when you talk about, like, slow path, are you thinking about, like, I just want to make sure I have the correct understanding of what you mean by that. So sure. Cases where basically, like, you have a happy path where things go and things go fast, and then if you hit some unusual case that doesn't usually happen, you get diverted to a slow path
exactly.
That is more rare and should not be treated as commonplace as the fast path. Is that the right understanding of what you mean when you say slow path?
Perfect. So you can see, if you're looking for some examples, if you check out the snmalloc repo, Microsoft/snmalloc on GitHub, which is the memory allocator that you and that partner put together, you'll see a ton of that where, hey, we're probably going to be able to allocate memory. Don't worry about it. Oh, we're not going to be able to allocate memory. This is a function call. Definitely bail out now. Don't pollute my happy path with any of that sad path code.
Okay. So you said like the current workaround is to like have developers identify the slow path and explicitly turn it into a function call.
Yeah.
Manual. And maybe some compiler annotation that says please don't inline this, please don't.
Exactly. And so I think, funnily enough, this is a legitimate machine learning problem. Not a phrase that I say all that often. Don't get me wrong. Machine learning has many uses, but, you know, maybe not all that many uses.
Well, it's like branch prediction.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're using machine learning for branch prediction these days.
I know. That's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, Theo. That's absolutely dead on, right? This is, in some sense, compile time branch prediction as a machine learning problem.
Yeah. I wonder if this can also link into, at one point, the annotations were added to Pony that were like, allowed you to say this branch is likely or unlikely, right? And that
yep.
results in us telling LLVM, like twiddling some LLVM flags that give it hints about branch prediction. But I wonder if it should also interact with, you know, inlining and or specialization or outlining.
Yeah. And, LLVM has some inlining stuff. I mean, it has a very weak inlining stuff where you get that number, right? Where the right number is 275 and no one's totally certain why. But it definitely doesn't have outlining, right? We're never going out and creating functions where we didn't have them before in order to reduce pressure. Don't get me wrong.
So in the specializations case, that would take the form of I'm trying to think of how this translates, right? So for specializations, you'd have cases where you do want to specialize in order to create this, like specializing is sort of like outlining and not so much like inline. Well, it's inlining in some ways and outlining in other ways because you're creating
Correct.
New static function calls that, like, based on the signature and you want to direct to the other function call if it has the other type signature.
And you may want to create those new static function calls if that would improve performance, but it won't necessarily always improve performance because it can be that the additional code and the additional pressure on the L1i is reducing performance and you'd prefer to have a single instantiation that use virtual dispatch because it's actually a slow path.
Yeah, we should come back to this idea that I think that all of these features, like with inlining and specialization, should have like language level annotations that you can use for particularly performance sensitive code. Say, please always inline this, please never inline this, please always specialize this, please don't specialize this.
Yeah.
And then in other cases where you have not annotated, it uses some heuristic that may be very bad or may be okay.
Yeah.
Back to
you. Yeah, so I've updated the repo with the get or else. Nothing has changed.
Okay.
Except the function is no longer partial, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, because it's got the default. So a zero comes in.
Yeah, so now it doesn't have the pony personality stuff.
But it does nothing.
Okay, so I think we have our thing for the RFC there, is that we'd like to see this functionality incorporated into Iter rather than bringing in the maybe one.
Yeah. Cool.
And we can see if Matthias is interested in doing that RFC. I don't know if he would be, because he opened the maybe one at my urging, right? Yeah. Because I expected it to be better. And I was just like, you know, so many people who are interested in Pony come in looking at being used to having this affordance. And while the fact that I write code that basically never needs these things, through, I don't know why, but I just don't with my Pony code. But I'm like, I've helped enough people in the beginner help where I've told them, hey, maybe you should go use Matthias's maybe library, right? That was like, that seems to me like that should be something that should be part of the standard library, if I'm telling people this often in beginner's help that, hey, you should use this library. But same thing, say, hey, Iter Tools is already there. Hey, here's how you use Iter Tools. We could have a little content in wherever is appropriate for, you know, directing people to it. Maybe even just like starting with like an FAQ, is there a maybe or some type, you know, in Pony, and like, here, this is what you want to use.
I think we already have that FAQ, but it just goes as far as saying we have union types.
Well, then now we can improve it.
Add this. Yeah.
Yeah, I might have added an FAQ for that just because I couldn't take answering it anymore. Yeah.
I have to say, this is something I have actually, like, since the RFC was opened, while working on the Pony tool stuff, like Pony Up as well as the new RFC tool stuff, I was like, oh my God, I really want this.
Okay. You write, I see that people write stuff where they want this. It's just, for whatever reason, the stuff that I write, I've never needed it.
Yeah,
but like when I'm
helping, it helps when you're messing with strings and stuff.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so you're gonna add this.
I'll leave a comment in the RFC.
So, a little bit of business before we get to the end here. A couple quick updates, and we'll open it up again and see if anybody has anything they want to bring up. Theo created a first version of an RFC tool, which I'm going to use to put into as part of some automation on the RFC repo, so that a lot of human interaction will be taken out of it in terms of creating issues on like the PonyC repo from the stuff, renaming the files once we merge stuff and everything else, and also add something so that when we change the status on things in RFC to like ready to vote, et cetera, it will automatically add that to last week in Pony, so that a human doesn't have to do it. The less humans have to do, the more likely it is to get done. And to let people know, I'm probably going to turn last week in Pony into its own repo. A GitHub repo, and have it actually, and have each last week in Pony actually be a release on that one, where the release has no attached packages or anything, but where all of the release notes would normally go, et cetera, and everything for a release, it would be that would be the content of the last week in Pony. This is nice for a couple of reasons. One is that GitHub has a ridiculously good API for scripting everything that would need to be done to automatically create these. And releases have an RSS feed, so we could still have an RSS feed for this. And it would allow me to turn Last Week into Pony into something which is completely generated without Theo or anybody else having to intervene in order to create it. And we'd be able to, if it's on its own repo, have people be able to tag for different categories of where their particular thing that they add is supposed to go, like releases, items of note, et cetera, and everything. And it can be completely community driven and done with pretty much no human intervention except for humans adding things every now and then to it. So I'll let folks know when that comes along. It will be a bit of a change. It will no longer be on the website. Anything before we're done that people want to bring up? All right, then. We are basically at end of time. Thank you, everyone, for coming. And I'll stop recording now. We'll see you next week.